Good evening, everyone. Thanks for being with us. Our thanks to Alejandro Rojas of MUFON, who was telling us about the upcoming 40th International UFO Symposium coming up August 6th through the 9th. And not to belabor the point, but, you know, it's one thing to learn about UFOs in books and online. It's another to go to one of these conferences. The MUFON Symposium has always been the most credible, the best in the business. And if you get a chance, you should really check it out, because it's great to be able to interact with these speakers and these experts on a firsthand basis. Coming up, Robert Hastings. He's been involved in UFO research about 30 years. He's written this book that I mentioned, UFOs and Nukes. It's one of the most disturbing and important books ever written on the topic. He's interviewed more than 100 former Air Force personnel who've seen this stuff with their own eyes. They were there. They've testified about it. They've used their real names, and their accounts are very chilling. When we come back, we'll jump right into it with Robert Hastings. Don't go away. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I've never had a chance to meet Robert Hastings in person, but he and I have exchanged a lot of emails, and I read the book, UFOs and Nukes. It's astonishing and sobering and disturbing. And he joins us now to talk about the massive accumulation of evidence that he's acquired over the years, including interviews with more than 100 U.S. Air Force veterans who saw these incidents for themselves. Robert, great to have you with us.
Hi, George. Good to talk to you finally.
I want to jump right into it. How many cases do you think you have total, worldwide, not just American cases, of where these things, whatever they are, intrude over nuclear weapons storage facilities, missile silos, things of that sort?
Well, I can directly attest to over 100 that I've investigated myself. I've tracked down the witnesses who were there, ranging from airmen to colonels who were involved in incidents at weapons storage areas, missile sites, nuclear bomber flight lines, and so on. I'm just guessing that there'd probably be a comparable number in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, as well as any other nuclear power. The thing to keep in mind is it's taken me 35 years just to track down 100 people, and the people are fairly reluctant to talk for the most part until I convince them what I'm doing is a research project and not something sensational. And once they realize where I'm coming from, they're usually quite eager to come on board. But I would estimate, I mean, there's no way to quantify this, but you know, for every one that I have uncovered, there's could be 10 or 100 or, you know, God knows how many more.
Well, we know it has happened in the U.S. We know it's happened in the USSR, and we'll get into some specifics in a minute. What about England, for example, other than the Bentwaters case, to the British nuclear facilities, India, Pakistan, Israel?
I have tried my very best to get solid leads from around the world of this type. I'm just now getting some information suggesting there have been incidents at France's ICBM sites, which are largely dismantled now, and at least at one of their nuclear bomber bases, the French Antard bomber, there was an incident that I'm just now trying to get the sources online to speak with me. I've heard rumors, anyone can find these rumors on the internet, about incidents in Israel and Pakistan and India, but personally, I've not been able to find anybody that I could sit down and say, this is a credible source, this person was there, this person can provide me the documentation indicating that he or she was there when all this went down. So it's not that it's not going on, it's just hard to wrestle it to the ground, so to speak.
Perhaps the thorniest question, and maybe it's too early in this interview to tackle this, and perhaps we'll have to come back to it at the end of the interview, but it's the obvious one, is why. What the agenda is. They appear over the facilities. Sometimes they interfere with launch codes, things of that sort. What's the agenda? Do you have an idea?
Well, I've spoken at over 500 colleges and universities nationwide since 1981, and what I tell my audiences is this, taking it one step at a time. If you look at the best UFO reports, the best documented cases, we're clearly dealing with a technology that is orders of magnitude beyond anything we have or any other country on Earth has. To me, that suggests that we're dealing with ETs or beings from other dimensions, or, you know, even future time travelers. I mean, you're in that realm. If one is familiar with theoretical physics, the cutting edge things that are being taught now at Cambridge and Yale and Oxford, we're talking about parallel universes. universes, faster than speed of light travel, things that even 20 years ago were considered heresy. So I think it's not extremely out of the question. I mean, I think it's certainly in the realm of possibility that we are dealing with ETs or something of that nature. If that is indeed the case, my research has demonstrated beyond any doubt that since the beginning of the nuclear age in 1945, after the first detonation of the bomb in New Mexico, the test, and then the subsequent bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, UFO activity at nuclear weapons-related sites has been an ongoing phenomenon. That suggests to me that whoever are flying these craft are indeed interested in monitoring our nuclear weapons program and the Soviets' program. Probably the same situation has occurred as we've discussed in the other countries that have nuclear weapons. In my opinion, the best case scenario is that these are beings who have our welfare at heart for reasons that we may not understand, whether it's moral, whether it's in their own self-interest or a combination of the two. They are attempting to send a signal, to wag a finger, to let the nuclear powers know that they know that we are playing with fire, and they intend to keep monitoring our nuclear weapons, and just to reinforce the point, to occasionally tamper with them. And we can get into some of the specific cases later. But they clearly are engaged in an ongoing surveillance of our nuclear weapons program, and in fact, occasionally tampering with the nukes. That's not even a question at this point, if you look at the testimony of the 100 or so persons that I've already interviewed.
You know, we'll get into specifics about an incident that occurred in Russia that I had a chance to investigate. It was from back in the early 80s, but the Russian Ministry of Defense folks who evaluated what happened, they felt that it was some sort of a demonstration of the technical mastery that these visitors, whoever they are, have over our most powerful weapon systems, as if to say, these might be the best you've got, but they aren't that impressive to us.
I think that's entirely consistent with what my sources have told me, and in fact, that's my working hypothesis, that indeed they are saying, we can shut down your nukes if we wish, and you know, you really should think twice about even having these things. I think that's the message that's being conveyed. Earlier you said you felt this was disturbing material. I'm inclined to think of it in a more optimistic way. If I were in the Pentagon or the CIA or the Kremlin, I would certainly find this disturbing if my strategic weapons systems were being compromised by forces unknown who clearly had a technological edge. However, as Joe Q. Public, just an average U.S. citizen, if indeed these are beings are attempting to warn our governments of the perils of having nuclear weapons, then to me that's an entirely positive development, and I hope that some, you know, attention is being paid to the signals that I think are being sent behind the scenes. Now, the Pentagon or the Kremlin is not going to really announce to their citizens, you know, we have no control over our nuclear weapons. You know, these guys flying the disc-shaped craft seem to come in at will and tamper with them. You know, you're never going to admit that. I mean, so all of this until, you know, some government or all governments announce that UFOs are real, no one is in an official capacity is ever going to admit that these nuclear weapons related cases have taken place.
And do you buy that that's the possible explanation for the cover up, for the denial on the part of our government, that they don't want to say that we are not in control of our nuclear weapons?
I have always felt that this was a major part of the secrecy, the fact that, you know, since World War II, we've lived in the nuclear age. During the Cold War, we were on the precipice of nuclear annihilation during the Cuban Missile Crisis. For your listeners old enough to remember that, I certainly do. And, you know, there was a period there where constantly we and the Soviets were saber-rattling. Things have slowly emerged. I mentioned them in my book, where the number of near misses, the Cuban Missile Crisis was only the first, or the best known, rather, but there were several other incidents where we or the Soviets were within minutes of pushing the button, and those stories, horror stories, are just now emerging. So that's the world that, you know, we've lived in, even in the post-World War, or excuse me, Cold War era. We've still got thousands of nuclear weapons. The Russians have thousands of nuclear weapons. Right now, we're on better terms, certainly, than we were with the Soviets. But history, you know, is nothing if not change. And there's nothing to say that 10 or 20 years down the road, there could be another crisis. And if we're still armed to the teeth and they're armed to the teeth, then the very real potential exists for nuclear annihilation. It's not a history lesson. It's current. It's with us.
Of course, we're going to get into a lot of specific instances that are covered in your book. The one I want to start with is what's known as the 1975 overflights. And this is a series of events along the U.S.-Canadian border where these northern tier American missile bases were visited, one right after another. And I remember the first time I heard about it, it was an article in the Washington Post that they had somehow acquired these documents, maybe through the Freedom of Information Act, and the story was out there. It made a minor rumble for a while, and then poof, it's gone. Would you give us that story, recap what happened, the series of events, and sort of give the listeners an idea what we're dealing with here?
Sure. Basically, chronologically, I think in early 1977, a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst, whose identity I know but I won't mention, leaked some documents relating to these UFO overflights, not only of missile bases, but B-52 bomber bases at Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Michigan and Loring Air Force Base, Maine, in addition to Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, and Minot in North Dakota, the last two bases being ICBM bases. In any case, this series of papers were leaked to NICAP, which was still in effect at the time, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. In any case, Todd Zeckel, who was a well-known researcher at the time, and Brad Sparks learned about these leaks to NICAP and actually succeeded in getting reference numbers on the documents and used those numbers to file Freedom of Information requests. Subsequent to that, the Air Force released highly edited NORAD logs dealing with this activity. And one of them just deals with, I've reproduced it in my book in its entirety, but it just case by case, moment by moment, you have UFOs, which are described as disc-shaped, flying and hovering over ICBM sites, Minuteman missile sites at Malmstrom Air Force Base. Describes the objects both hovering and flying at high rates of speed. They were initially not visible on radar. Once they were picked up on radar, jet interceptors were launched to attempt intercepts of them. The documents state, the NORAD logs state, that as the jets approached the UFOs extinguished their illumination and were low to the terrain. The jets couldn't find them and returned to base unsuccessfully. Once the jets had returned to base, the UFOs re-illuminated themselves and again were maneuvering around missile sites. Pretty dramatic stuff. And at the same time, at Loring Air Force Base, for example, in Maine, which was a B-52 bomber base at the time, the documents describe objects hovering over what are called WSAs, weapons storage areas, where nuclear bombs were stored. The same thing happened at Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Michigan. And on two occasions, you had personnel on the ground, security personnel approaching the UFO, at which point it races away at a high rate of speed. So all of this was going on, over about a two-week period at various SAC, Strategic Air Command, bases. So that's the type of thing that has happened when my father was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 66, 67. There were even a more dramatic incident involving shutdown of entire flights of 10 missiles on two separate occasions in March of 1967. And there have been subsequent events in the 80s and even 90s of UFO activity at ICBM sites. Probably the best well-known are these 1975 overflights.
Back to your mention of your start in this field, basically, is because your father was assigned to one of these bases, right?
He was was career Air Force. He was in from 47 to 67. His last assignment was Malmstrom Air Force Base, Great Falls, Montana, which was at that time and is to this day a Minuteman nuclear missile base. And he worked in a building called the SAGE building. It was a state-of-the-art computer-assisted radar system that the Air Force and NORAD used to track North American airspace to cover it and monitor any incursions by Soviet bombers and so on. And it had both Air Force, Air Defense Command, and FAA air traffic controllers in this large building. At the same time he was there, I was a junior in high school. Three nights a week, I had a job at the Malmstrom Air Traffic Control Tower and just basically pushed a broom and emptied trash cans. I was just a few weeks shy of being 17 years old. And one of the rooms I cleaned regularly was called RAPCON, Radar Approach and Control, where both Air Force and FAA controllers were monitoring incoming and outgoing aircraft at the base. And over the course of several months, I developed a friendship, or at least a relationship, with one of the FAA controllers. I was very curious about how radar worked, and this gentleman was gracious enough to tell me during his breaks how it worked, its theory, and so on and so forth. And one night, and I guesstimated that it was mid to late March of 67, while I was in there, that room cleaning up, he just motioned me over to his scope and told me he was tracking UFOs. And, you know, I was kind of startled and taken aback and asked a couple of questions. And probably within a minute or so, he got much more businesslike and told me to come back later. All he really told me was that jets had been launched to investigate, was his term. So later that night when I came back, it was clear he did not want to talk about this. I guess he had decided he had already said too much, but in any case, I never brought it up to him again. He clearly did not want to talk about it. So I don't know, you know, after I left the room, whether he was chastised or just thought better of it. But I did tell my father, and unbeknownst to me, he made some inquiries at work and came back and probably a day or two later said, you know, those weren't UFOs. Those were Soviet surveillance aircraft. And that's the rumor around work. And I pointed out to my father that the controller had told me that these five objects were hovering at the time I stood before the scope. And that's indeed what they were doing to my eye. They were just stationary. So a couple of weeks or thereabouts went by, and again, my father just kind of said quietly to me when he came home from work one day that no, these were bona fide UFOs, and the word is they were maneuvering near ICBM sites out of Judith Basin. And that's probably all he knew, and it was probably a third-hand rumor at that point, but that was what was going on at work in terms of the rumor mill.
You know, it would almost be a worse or scarier if they really were Russians, if the Russians had something that could hover over our ICBM bases and there's nothing we could do about it.
Right. Yeah, it was pretty tense times, you know, during the Cold War, for your listeners old enough to remember what it was like. I know that when I was I went to Air Force Base schools virtually until the time I went to college. And even in high school, we had regular atomic bomb drills where you had to go into the hallway and lean your face against the wall and pretend that you could survive a nuclear attack that way. It was just pretty harrowing times. But that's what sparked my interest. And in 1973, Raymond Fowler and another researcher, Don Kehoe, had mentioned in their writings that there were sightings, rumors of UFO activity at ICBM sites at Malmstrom and Minot and elsewhere. And I was hooked. I just thought, you know, this was real, and I wanted to see how widespread it was. So I just began informally interviewing former and retired Air Force personnel. I made a conscious decision early on not to approach active duty personnel. I thought that if my discussions with these people got back to their superiors, their careers could be in jeopardy if they were talking to me. So even though those would be the logical people to get the most current information from, I've just made a decision after, you know, early on in this 35-year quest to not only talk to people who are no longer in the military, but at this point I've got over 100, it's pushing 120 now, witnesses who were at missile sites and elsewhere who have just some very dramatic things to say.
And one of those guys is Patrick McDonough, who was stationed at Malmstrom in the mid-60s. When we come back, we'll hear he'll be joining us, and we'll hear his part of the story. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. A lot more to come with Robert Hastings. We're talking with Robert Hastings, author of the book UFOs and Nukes. And you can imagine it'd be pretty tough to find a military and former military guys to come forward and talk about these kinds of things, worried about what would happen if they speak openly and their identities are attached to their testimony. Well, Robert Hastings has managed to find several dozen of folks like this, including Patrick McDonough. And 43 years ago, he was working at Malmstrom Air Force Base when something very strange, very unusual, and very scary happened to him. When we come back, we'll hear that story. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. My name is George Knapp. We're talking with Robert Hastings, author of the book UFOs and Nukes, jam-packed with some bone-chilling incidents of things that happened, intrusions over nuclear missile bases and SAC bases. And we are joined now by Patrick McDonough, who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base back in 1966. Patrick, you there?
I'm here. Hi, George. Hi, Robert.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah. Thank you. Robert, why don't you tell us how it was that you and Patrick came into contact with each other? I would imagine it's pretty tough to get some of these guys to come forward.
Well, if I recall correctly, and Pat can correct me if I'm wrong, he wrote to me. He heard me on Coast to Coast back in February and wrote to me afterward. Is that correct, Pat?
Yes, that is correct. I was kind of surprised to hear about all these other people that had incidents with UFOs at our U.S. missile bases, because here I had one, and I said, well, I'll just email them about mine, and from that, here I am.
And that's the shows the power of Coast to Coast, ladies and gentlemen. Patrick, this is 43 years ago this happened. How clear are your memories?
Pretty clear. I have a pretty vivid recollection of the events that evening.
Tell us the story. What was your job, first of all, and then tell us how it unfolded.
Okay. Well, I joined the Air Force in early 1960, November 1962, at the onset of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And at that time, I had 3 years of college in engineering. And being a patriotic young man, I thought, well, are we going to war with the Soviets or not? You know, it looked pretty grim at those days. And so off to the Air Force I went, and the Air Force selected me to become a geodetic surveyor. I was assigned to the only squadron in the Air Force that did geodetic survey work, and that was located in Orlando Air Force Base. And in 1965, our squadron was moved to F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne, Wyoming. My normal job, I usually spent like 9 to 10 months a year on temporary duty away from Warren Air Force Base, surveying for latitude, longitude for our missile sites and aircraft for positioning their guidance systems.
Basically, so as part of targeting kind of a thing?
Yes. Basically, the squadron's mission was to provide the precise coordinates for a missile or aircraft's inertial guidance system so it knows where it is before it takes off, and then the intelligence groups would provide the coordinates on its target or where it's to go. So it had to know two things. It had to know where it was at and where it's going. And we did where it was at. Very precise.
And important work.
Yeah, I think so. It'll, of course, won't hit its target if it doesn't know where it started from. So
September 1966, what happens?
Well, myself and two other airmen were living off base at Malmstrom Air Force Base. We were off of Malmstrom in a hotel in Conrad, Montana. And we were doing the initial surveys for the last 50 missile sites. They were putting in, they had already had 150 operational there in the wing. And we were putting the fourth squadron or another 50 missile sites and new ones. And I was assigned to SATAF and Boeing. SATAF was the Site Activation Task Force. It was Boeing's prime contractor. And I was the chief of party of our little small three-man team. And we would normally go out to a missile site in the late afternoon and set up our instruments as work was primarily done at night. We were completing a series of celestial astro-azimuth observations at a missile site. It was southeast of Conrad. And the unusual thing about this missile site was that the hatch of the silo was left open because they were waiting to put a missile to be installed at that site. And that was kind of unusual. They didn't normally leave them open. They were usually closed, even though they were empty. But this one was unusual in that it was left open. And we were nearing completion of our star observations, and we're at the missile monolith, which is about 25 feet or so from the actual missile site, the missile silo. And probably around 1 to 1:30 a.m. in the morning, this unidentified flying object just kind of appeared almost like from out of nowhere from the north. It stopped directly over us at the missile site. And
describe it. Is it how was it shaped? What color was it? Was it glowing or?
It was probably it was round, circular, and I would say it was probably about 300 feet above us. It appeared to have a number of kind of pulsating dim lights outlining the disk. And it had a brighter white light emanating down towards us and down inside the center of the open silo.
And is it making any sound?
No, there was no sound. There was no wind. It was very strange.
Not a helicopter?
No, not a helicopter.
Not a plane?
No, sir.
So what did it do?
Well, it stayed there above us for probably 20, 30 seconds at the most. And then, you know, during this time, it's sitting there because obviously now I can't see the stars. This thing's above us. And I started thinking to myself, just, you know, what would happen if we were beamed up and taken off to some distant planet? Really, this is going through my mind, you know.
Understandably.
That never to return here to Earth again. And then just from this dead stop sitting above us, it sped off to the east at a really tremendous speed. I mean, it was, now you see it, now you don't. Off it went. And it departed, I mean, we just grabbed all of our gear and jumped in our truck and departed the missile site.
What are you guys saying to each other?
We were kind of a little, all three of us were really kind of a little scared and wanted to get the heck out of there. We did not want to stick around if it came back. We were time to depart the area.
Do you get on the radio and tell anybody, or did you even have a radio there?
We did not have a radio. We had a brand-new truck that actually GSA provided us that afternoon. They had trucked it up to Conrad and had unloaded it and gave us the keys. And, I mean, it was a truck without a radio or anything. And we weren't really in contact with Malmstrom Air Force Base. We were up there working on our own with Boeing, the prime contractor.
So you jump in the truck, and these guys, brand new truck that they'd just given you. I guess that was probably they were going to regret that later. Tell me what happened
yes.
with the truck.
I'm sure they did. We sped away from the missile site to return to Conrad, and I was probably speeding. But en route there, they were taking the roads around Conrad, and the Army Corps of Engineers were base rocking these roads. To take the weight of the missiles. And as we went over this crest of a small hill and the headlights came down, you know, we saw the road had abruptly ended as it was teed, and you either went to the left or right. Trouble is we were going a little too fast, and I tried to turn to the left, and the two right tires of the truck blew out, and we ended up flipping upside down.
Any injuries?
No one was injured. Even our instruments were okay, surprisingly.
Okay, so you see this thing, you're kind of frightened by it, disturbed by it. You jump in the truck, take off, roll the truck. Then what happens? I mean, do you eventually somebody comes and gets you? Do you report that what
well,
you saw?
Well, we don't have a radio or anything. We saw a light, and we said, "Well, there's a farmhouse," and we started walking, and we walked for a couple hours. It was probably 10 miles to this farmhouse where we woke the farmer up and called the Montana Highway Patrol. The farmer drove us back to the accident site. The highway patrolman arrived, and he told us that his dispatch had received over 20-some reports from local residents observing the UFO in the area.
So it's not just you guys seeing this thing?
Oh, correct.
Well, eventually you've got to tell somebody what happened, somebody in the military. How did that go down?
Well, yeah, so the next almost like 3 days I wrote reports. I had to write to SATAF, the Site Activation Task Force, Boeing, and the state of Montana. But, you know, what's very unusual was I never heard from the Air Force about the incident, and there was no retribution, no reimbursement was ever requested for me totaling that truck. I never did mention the UFO incident and truck accident to my squadron headquarters at Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne when I went back there, because I was about to be discharged and I really didn't want to buy the truck. And I also didn't want to go to the base psychiatrist.
So nobody came to tell you, hey, this didn't happen?
No, nobody did that. It was just kind of unusual, actually. I mean, it seemed in those days, if you broke or wrecked something, you were going to end up having to reimburse the government for it. And here I totaled this truck and they didn't do anything.
Well, look, after the dust settles and you get to talk to your buddies who are there, do you go over the thing? What really happened? What the heck did we see? That kind of stuff?
Yeah, we talked about it then, and at the time it really happened, we were really concerned about buying this truck, which, you know, was not in our budget. We just kind of moved on, and I went back to college. I got my doctorate. I joined the Naval Reserve Intelligence Program. I became the Command Master Chief of Naval Intelligence for the Reserves.
Aha, you're a spook, see?
Yeah, and I always looked for, I was always just kind of looking to see if I could ever find out and get read in on one of the programs that had UFOs, but I never really talked about it. I did not want to them to think I was a nut.
Would it have been inappropriate for you to go to a superior officer, you know, days or weeks later and say, what was that? Anybody have any ideas on what we saw? Any other information kind of a thing?
I didn't do that. None of us did. We just kind of, didn't want to lose our clearances and let that, something like that, we just wanted to finish our service and get out in the next few months, and I wanted to go back to college. And, it's something that I didn't think would benefit us talking about it.
If I can interject here.
Sure.
I have heard this time and time again from people who guarded missile sites or worked at missile sites. In my book, I mentioned case after case where the people said, we saw it. And we knew we'd heard rumors that anybody reported seeing UFOs going to the base psychiatrist, and sometimes your job was at an end. You know, they had this program called PRP, Personnel Reliability Program, which basically said if you work around nuclear weapons or guard nuclear weapons, you know, you've got to have a squeaky clean reputation. You can't be into drugs or any kind of problem-making activity. And the last thing you want to do if you want to keep your job and keep your career in the Air Force to say that you saw a UFO hovering over a missile site. So many, many reports, I'm sure, have gone unreported, and many sightings have gone unreported because of that factor. The other thing I'll mention here quickly is back in 2007, I think, I interviewed a civilian named Ryan Ruhr, who lives in Conrad. His family has a farm east of town, this same area where the last 50 missile sites were set up that Pat's talking about. Those, that squadron has now been decommissioned as part of the nuclear downsizing that we have, the treaties we have with the Russians. And so those missile sites are still up there. They're just holes in the ground at this point. But in December 2006, Ryan Ruhr told me on two separate occasions he was coming home and saw UFOs, I mean, bright lights that were just flying right-angle turns at high rates of speed. And the place he described seeing them, I got out a map and found out they were quite near three separate missile sites, three of these now deactive missile sites. And this was not even 3 years ago. So this kind of activity is still going on up in the same area that Pat's describing, you know, occurring in 1966.
That's what I was wondering about, Robert. When you have somebody like Patrick come forward and tell this story, had you already heard about or had indications that this particular incident had occurred or something like it? And as part of that question, how do you go about verifying who Patrick is and that he was where he says he was?
Well, generally, I'm getting DD-214s from people who have talked to me just to verify their service records. I have not did not hear of this specific incident, but I had talked to another person who was in his same squadron, the 1381st Geodetic Survey Squadron, I believe the title is.
Yes, that's right.
And this gentleman was at Vandenberg Air Force Base in early 67 and described a UFO coming in and hovering over one of the Minuteman missile test sites there where they did test launches over the Pacific. So I had talked to somebody else in his squadron who had a similar incident. They did not see the UFO, but they got reports from the base police over the radio. They heard of activity at this one missile site. All they saw was an extremely bright light hovering over the silo. So in any case, it's not unlike many, many other cases I've heard, not only at Malmstrom, but elsewhere.
And this is the kind of case where there's nothing filed that mentions a UFO that we know of, so you can't file a FOIA later and try to get any paper trail.
Exactly. As I mentioned in my book, in the early 80s, I made an effort to get paperwork through the FOIA on the incidents at Malmstrom, and I just had the door slammed in my face repeatedly. We have no documents. We don't know what you're talking about, and so on and so forth was basically the response I got. Now, what I have found, though, based on the testimony of the people who were interviewed, were debriefed, generally OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, was involved, and those were the persons who took the testimony of the witnesses and swore them to secrecy. They were required to sign non-disclosure agreements, national security non-disclosure agreements, and so forth. But officially speaking, you know, if you try to get documents from OSI, they claim they have no documents on UFO activity whatsoever. And I find it interesting that Captain Edward Ruppelt, who was the first chief of Project Blue Book back in the early 50s, as early as 1952, he mentioned in a Life magazine article that the Air Force had records of 63 incidents involving UFO activity at atomic weapons sites. Now, when the Blue Book files were declassified in the early 70s, those particular cases were not a part of the documents that were declassified. So, you know, the great majority of the documentation, you know, the national security related stuff is still secret and probably will remain so for the foreseeable future.
Patrick, I know you didn't want to stay for the entire program, so I wanted to at least touch on this before you go. Mm-hmm. You know, you've had time to think about it. You don't strike me as a sort of a UFO crazy guy, but it's had to have sparked your interest in the topic, and you've had to have thought about it since then. I mean, what was that you saw, and what do you think it was doing?
Well, I'll tell you, throughout my 4 years with the Geodetic Survey Squadron, I had worked on the latest missiles and aircraft that was in the U.S. Air Force inventory because they used the same type of inertial guidance systems. I worked on the SR-71. I worked with Martin Marietta, Boeing, Lockheed. I went to SRI. And I never saw any Air Force aircraft that could perform like this unidentified flying object did. Never saw anything like it, and nor since. So it's the strangest thing. I think they're out there, and that was just really my kind of experience with this. The only one I had. But
Patrick McDonough, thanks for joining us. If you don't mind, stick around for a couple more minutes. I got a couple more questions for you, then we'll let you go. We'll be right back with more of our interview with Patrick McDonough and Robert Hastings about UFOs and nukes. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM.